It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. The topic for today is the fourth and my favorite paramita, the Virya paramita, which is, I think the correct translation of Virya is heroic, but I prefer joyful effort. But what is that really? And here's a formula. So it's said that aspiration is the wellspring of energy. So when we aspire to something, we get energy toward that thing. And bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, is the aspiration to become a Buddha for the welfare of all beings, the great earth, the mountains and rivers. Bodhicitta then is the wellspring of joyful effort. It's just mathematical. Interestingly, bodhicitta arises in the world in four different ways. And they're all call and response, even though you don't know you're doing it. So the first way is you don't know that you're asking for compassionate guidance from the universe, and you don't know that you're receiving it, but you are anyway. The imperceptible form of communion is always happening. It's always happening whether we know it or not. So the first way that bodhicitta arises in the world is this imperceptible asking and receiving compassion and a compassionate response from the universe. And the second way is we know that we're asking, but we can't tell we're receiving anything. And the third way is we don't perceive that we're asking, but we do perceive things coming our way. And the fourth way is that we perceive both. We perceive ourselves calling and receiving a response of compassion from the universe. So which one are you? Which one describes your relationship with calling and responding of compassion, calling for compassion and receiving that, being aware that you're receiving that response? Recently, Reb held a meeting at No Abode regarding his succession, so regarding his death. And he said that during the time that he's still alive, so long as we continue to ask him to teach, he will continue to teach. But as soon as we stop asking him, he will stop teaching. And every New Year's, students they actually write a letter to their teacher, him, and ask him to continue teaching, please, in whatever form we want, whatever words we want to use. And then he reads these letters and then he continues teaching. But if we stop sending those letters in the new year, that's the end. So there's this call and response. And I want you to hear this because it includes you asking questions. We're doing it right now, right here. You ask questions or give comments at the end of my talk. So I give a talk. So I present the Dharma and you ask me to clarify the Dharma by asking questions. That's the same call and response. That's exactly the same. So we're involved in this at all times, I think. And mostly we don't even think about it. So whether we know it or not, we don't practice alone on the Bodhisattva path. We practice together with all Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and sentient beings. But the thought of enlightenment, bodhicitta, needs to be cared for. And it's cared for by these six paramitas that we're talking about. And today we're talking about the fourth one, joyful effort. Reb tells another story about being at Tassajara and hearing this word disciple kind of tossed around. And he asked Suzuki Roshi, "Who are your disciples?" And Roshi answered, "There are people here who are practicing for themselves, and there are others who are here who are practicing for others. And it's the people here who are practicing for others that are my disciples." And in other words, those here with the mind of awakening, with the aspiration to become a Buddha for the welfare and liberation of all living beings, the mountains and rivers, and the great earth. Those are the ones who are his disciples. If we cultivate the intention to benefit ourselves with compassion, it will grow into including others. So it's important to return over and over to our aspiration, because that's the wellspring of our enthusiasm for continued practice. And it goes both ways. All six great bodhisattva practices help us care for our aspiration, and our aspiration fuels all six practices. And refueling comes on reflection on what we want to do. This reflection regenerates an interest in practice. Bodhisattvas enthusiastically aspire to enlightenment, and they inspire to the enlightenment that's expressed by these practices. And it helps to see others practice too. It helps to see the example in other people. So in no special order, here are 12 attributes of the paramita of heroic or joyful effort. The first one is passionate enthusiasm. So when first starting out on the Dharma, on the path of the Dharma, there's often a lot of enthusiasm, but after a while, you just go through the motion and practice becomes sort of stale. But not to let it. Just like in any relationship, it's really important to renew our intentions daily. And the effort to do this is almost a practice in itself. Or skip the almost. The effort to renew our enthusiasm is a practice in itself. It's like we need, and that's for all relationships, not just this one. You could say that your connection with your practice is a relationship, and it requires daily renewal of effort. The next one, so the first one is passion and enthusiasm. The next one is vow. So as we continue to explore and care for our intention, we may see that the next appropriate step is to make a vow. And so we vow to live in accord with our aspiration of bodhicitta. Aspiration and bodhicitta are the same thing. And the main difference between vow and aspiration is that vow implies a commitment. And once the vow is made, all the bodhisattva practices protect and sustain it. And in turn, our practice revitalizes our vow. And I think that this confession and repentance is a compassionate way to repair vows when they're broken. And I find a compassionate way to sustain vows even when they're not broken. The third is consistency. And Reb emphasizes consistency over excessiveness. So reflecting on our aspiration to awaken, once a day or twice a day is not too much to reflect on that. And you may remember this wonderful story of Zen Master Zwigan. Every morning he called out to himself, "Master," and then he said, "Yes, sir. Are you awake?" And, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Now, all day long, do not be deceived by others. I won't. I won't." And this not being deceived by others means not allowing oneself to let the confusion or lack of straightforwardness and bad habits of others to deter you. Because environment is stronger than will. So it means if we surround ourselves with others who are confused, we on our own will not have the strength to not become confused as well. So our job is to surround ourselves with those whose lives represent the standards that we want for ourselves. And it may mean taking a hard look at our life, and it could even mean changing friends. But it's this thing about environment is stronger than will is really important. And it will get you if you don't consciously make sure that you're surrounded by people who represent the kind of life that you want to live. The fourth quality is joy. When we're joyful, when we practice, but we're not trying to get joy. Our practice is joy. We're not trying to get joy from our practice. Our practice is joy. It is joyful to practice Buddhism. It truly is. And I hope that you experience that. The fifth one is rest. Not stopping when stopping is the correct way is a mistake. So it's because it's going with inertia. It's the unconscious pull instead of what one knows is best. For example, when we're fatigued, rest is appropriate. And while sometimes it's easier to continue doing something rather than stop, it's just a way of being tied to what's right in front of us. I'm thinking of computer work. But it's our responsibility, as well as delight, to rest when needed and to take good care of our practice, when rest is needed to take good care of our practice. to rest when rest is appropriate promotes our ability to make good choices, and insufficient rest promotes mistakes. So rest is the fifth quality of joyful effort. Heroism is the sixth. One of the reasons bodhisattva effort is called heroic is because we foolishly enter it wholeheartedly, even though we don't know actually what we're doing. We don't know what we're getting into. And we sort of jump in to Buddhist practice without fully knowing what it is. And that's heroic, actually. Bodhisattvas vow to enter the wisdom of the Buddhas and to help other beings enter wisdom. Bodhisattvas don't necessarily think their actions are helpful, but they definitely want them to be helpful. Our process toward perfect wisdom begins with our aspiration to carry all beings beyond suffering into a life of peace and freedom. When we commit to this aspiration, it becomes a vow, and later the vow and the development of wisdom develops into perfect wisdom. And like a fool, we jump into this whole thing and we trust our aspiration. But it's more than just trust, actually. We intuitively know that we're doing the right thing. The fifth quality is perseverance. We never give up. We're always moving forward on the bodhisattva path, even though it may not look that way to us. To be great practitioners, we have to keep returning to our original aspiration, and in order to sustain our enthusiasm, we need to do this too. Akin Roshi puts it really well. He says, the human being by nature is inadequate, practices Zazen inadequately, realizes true nature inadequately. This is the Virya Paramita. On and on, we persevere like a small child determined to learn how to walk while continually falling down, or like a very old person getting up in the middle of the night, lurching from wall to wall to reach the bathroom. Those are Akin Roshi's words. He's dead now, but he was a wonderful teacher in Hawaii. And I love those words. It describes perseverance perfectly. The eighth one is distraction control. On his great realization under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha exclaimed, all beings are the Tathagata. Only their delusions and preoccupations keep them from testifying to that fact. Tathagata means the one who thus comes, another name for Buddha, who says, rid yourself of delusions and preoccupations or distractions, and you've got it. Now, this is Akin Roshi. Rid yourself of delusions and preoccupations, and you've got it. He affirms, you have a hard time with this because your nature is the same as Buddha's. He had to practice hard too. Don't give up. And Akin Roshi also says, circumstances are like your arms and legs. They appear in your life to serve your practice. As you become more and more settled in your purpose, your circumstances begin to synchronize with your concerns. And this is true, I think. So distraction control, we really need to pay attention to our mind and get control of it. Another part of heroic effort around this is to ask for and receive assistance when we need help. Through conversations in the midst of difficulties, we will be able to heroically engage and complete the most advanced practices. So we need to speak up, ask for help, get all the guidance we need, and not to allow distractions to usurp the main energy of our life force. The ninth one is thoroughgoing, to be thoroughgoing. Dogen says that when one is not full of the Dharma, one feels that it is complete. When one is full of the Dharma, something seems to be lacking. And Aitken Roshi comments, when you think you are complete, there is something lacking in your body and mind. When you know there is something missing, you are complete. That's an awareness of not yet, not enough. Not enough yet. So thoroughgoing is moment by moment discovering not enough. Why? Because we have a big job. I'm bringing you some of my favorite sayings of Aitken Roshi. That's another one. And the next one is compassion. When we get frustrated by what seems to be a lack of progress, this is a big opportunity. It's feedback that we're forgetting to be compassionate, that is generous, ethical, and patient with our frustration. To be great practitioners, we have to keep returning to our original aspiration in order to sustain our enthusiasm to become heroes of awakening or enlightenment. A good example of this is what I call, when is it going to be over? The when is it going to be over syndrome during Zazen? And this is a way of actually keeping yourself from doing Zazen, allowing Zazen to do Zazen. It's better to return to your original aspiration and try it and keep on trying it. That's our way. Single-minded zeal is another one. There's delight in our work. Large-scale, fearless, enthusiastic, and highly focused energy. Single-minded zeal. And exertion, the last one. So laziness is our biggest obstacle. And it disappears in the face of joyful effort. Usually, laziness is related to not having figured out what our ultimate purpose is in our life. But with exertion, first knowing your, oh my goodness, something. Exertion means first knowing our ultimate purpose, and from there, good scheduling and good organization will just naturally follow. The practice of Dharma actually gets in your blood so that you regard exertion as part of your basic natural activity rather than something imposed from the outside. It just happens naturally, actually. So a little bit more about laziness. Overwork is a form of laziness. Taking on things that are too advanced is a form of laziness. Not stopping when you've done enough is another form of laziness. And taking on practices that we might have to quit halfway through is another. And laziness, as we've said, is the main obstacle to joyful effort. And it usually shows up in one of three ways. Just ordinary laziness. We keep falling asleep and we're unable to get ourselves together, which means usually we've not organized our lives around our ultimate purpose, and we begin to feel that we're victims of our lives rather than of our own laziness. So don't forget, this is, I'm saying that laziness is the result of not having figured out what the ultimate purpose is in your life, and keep returning to that again and again so that it's manifested. You can see your ultimate purpose in almost every move you make. The second form of this, so that's ordinary laziness. You don't do that. Losing heart is another form of laziness. And that looks like, how is it possible for someone like me to attain enlightenment? It's impossible, and I shouldn't even try. In fact, what's the point of doing anything? It's said that we lose heart because we like samsara too much. We don't want to give up our treasures. That's what it said in Buddhism. But this final one is the biggest one, I think. It's called preoccupied laziness. This is the laziness of being preoccupied with activities other than dharmic ones and exerting ourselves in those situations instead of devoting ourselves to dharma practice. Don't forget, you can make a lot of things practice just by making them a practice. So it doesn't have to be like explicitly listening to a Dharma talk or doing Zazen. It could be doing other things that you've deemed a practice. But this preoccupied laziness, we become preoccupied with activities other than dharmic ones. And this one, it says that in truth, we couldn't care less about the Dharma. This type of laziness is the most dangerous because we're using our life to avoid practice. We feel extraordinarily energetic when we exert ourselves in other things, but when it comes to sitting, we're very lazy. We'd rather vacuum the floor. This is called preoccupied laziness. The antidote to laziness is first compassion. We must have compassion for ourselves when we see that we're lazy. Second, we try to understand our laziness, getting to the heart of the problem and address the heart of the problem, which is knowing our ultimate purpose in life. Addressing that instead of laziness, laziness is the symptom. Third, we need to cultivate a sense of urgency around the Dharma, practice itself with a no matter what attitude is the key. And the key to that is remembering impermanence. We could die today. So again, remembering our ultimate purpose, whatever that is for you. And then remembering impermanence, that you don't have that much time. You don't know how much time you have, and it could be not very much. I'd like to read you a story of one of Buddha's disciples, Purna, who was foremost in teaching the Dharma. And he is an inspiring example of the no matter what joyful effort. So this version that I'm going to read you is told by a modern Chinese Zen master. Among the Buddha's disciples there were those who were wonderful speakers of deep faith and majestic in bearing. These speakers traveled from place to place to help spread the Buddha's teachings. Among these highly regarded disciples, Purna was known as foremost in teaching the Dharma. Not only was he eloquent of tongue and deep of faith, Purna had the spirit of a true teacher. In one case, Honorable Purna, and honorable is an acknowledgement for his wisdom, being one with ultimate truth. So Honorable Purna listened to the Buddha speak, and he waited until everyone had gone and before approaching the Buddha. After kneeling and paying his respects, Purna said, "Buddha, as your disciples, we have you as our teacher. We rely on the true Dharma. This is truly a most fortuitous opportunity, our highest honor. I believe that everyone seeks refuge in the Buddha, not for the sake of food and clothing, not for the sake of joining Buddhist community and finding a place of sanctuary, but for the sake of cultivating our wisdom, spreading the true Dharma of the Buddha in the world, and benefiting all beings. This is our aspiration. Now I beg the Buddha, in his compassion, to allow me to go to the kingdom of Sunaparanta to spread the teachings there." When the Buddha heard Purna's words, he grew very happy. But the great teacher, the Buddha, knew the difficulties of spreading the Dharma. And obviously, he had been trying to spread the Dharma, and said earnestly to Purna, "Purna, teaching sentient beings, benefiting oneself and others, and spreading the true Dharma, these are all worthy aspirations. However, you do not necessarily have to travel to Sunaparanta to teach. It would be better if you chose a different place. You should start your travels tomorrow. We will happily see you off." Not understanding his meaning, Purna gazed questioningly at the Buddha's benevolent countenance and said, "Buddha, I do not understand. Is not any location where people reside a good place to spread the Dharma? Now that I have aspired to go to Sunaparanta, a place where the teachings have yet to be heard, why do you ask that I choose another destination?" The Buddha explained, "Purna, the kingdom of Sunaparanta is a small and desolate place. Due to the difficulty of traveling there, the culture has not developed. The people there are violent and ruthless, while fighting and berating others is commonplace. Outsiders often meet their deaths there. Are you not afraid to go there to teach?" After hearing the Buddha's concern, Purna smiled, yet remained resolute, saying, "Buddha, you care for your disciples so compassionately that we find it difficult to express our gratitude. In order to repay your kindness, I would be willing to offer up what insignificant little I have to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to all living beings. It is precisely because Sunaparanta is such a barbarous place and no one else dares set foot there that I must propagate the Dharma there. Once there, I am aware that all manner of danger await me. But for the sake of propagating the true Dharma, such trifling matters as my own safety are not worth considering. May the Buddha's light shine upon me and allow me to go and found a pure land on earth." The Buddha's face radiated benevolent light. He was both moved by and delighted by Purna's willingness to sacrifice himself for the Dharma. And yet the Buddha still wished to test the strength of Purna's will. He turned to Purna and asked in a familiar manner, "Purna, The words you have spoken are not wrong in the least. As disciples of the Buddha, the two activities of teaching and practice are of utmost importance. However, if the people of Sunaparanta do not accept your teaching, but curse you and scold you instead, how would you feel? Without hesitation, Purna replied, if they curse me, I will think of them as good people. They are not barbarians, for they limit themselves to yelling rather than beating me. What if they use fists, stones, or clubs to beat you? The Buddha asked. I will still think them to be good people, Purna replied, for then they use only fists, stones, and clubs to beat me, but cannot bear to take swords and stab me. What if they use swords to stab you? I will still think them to be good people, for they still have their humanity and do not go so far as to kill me. And what if they kill you? The Buddha inquired. Then I will be indebted to them, for they have killed my impermanent body, helping me enter nirvana. They would have helped me use my life to repay the kindness of the Buddha. Although this would not be a great hindrance to me, it is regrettable that this would not be of any benefit to them. It would not be a great hindrance to him because he knows that with death, he goes nowhere but to the source. Everything is interconnected. Filled with joy, the Buddha praised Purna. You have shown yourself to be a true disciple. You were able to keep your peace in practice, teaching, and patience. Beings who wish to be disciples of the Buddha, fulfilling the duties of teaching and benefiting others, must bear spirits like yours. After hearing the Buddha's wise words and encouragement, Purna was deeply moved and inspired. His resolve to spread the Dharma was stronger than ever. After paying his respects to the Buddha, Purna began his journey to Sunaparanta amidst the cheers of many bhikkhus that gathered to see him off. Not long thereafter, Purna gathered together more than 500 disciples and built 500 monasteries in Sunaparanta. His reputation as the foremost teacher of the Dharma in the monastic community began to spread. Finally, the Honorable Purna became a famous teacher of the Dharma, bringing joy to the Buddha and receiving his praise. So that's my example of joyful effort to you. It's an extreme one. But he succeeded in everything he set out to do. So here are some of the most important points from today's talk. There's seven of them. First, there is delight in our work, large scale, fearless, single-minded zeal. I think Purna was a really good example of that. Second, it's important to return over and over to our aspiration because it is a wellspring of our enthusiasm for continued practice. And it goes both ways. All six great bodhisattva practices help us care for our aspiration, which is bodhicitta, or the mind of awakening. And our heroic aspiration, bodhicitta, fuels all our six practices. So bodhicitta fuels these six paramitas, and the practice of the six paramitas fuels our mind of awakening, our bodhicitta. Third, daily effort to renew our intentions is the practice itself. This is how our enthusiasm is expressed. Reflecting on our aspiration to awaken over and over, once a day, twice a day, is not too much. Fourth, environment is stronger than will. It means that if we surround ourselves with others who are confused, we on our own will not have the strength to not become confused too. Therefore, our job is to surround ourselves with those whose lives represent the standards we want for ourselves. Fifth, to rest when rest is called for promotes our ability to make continuous good choices. Insufficient rest promotes mistakes. Sixth, Aitken Roshi puts it beautifully, the human being by nature is inadequate, practices Zazen inadequately, realizes true nature inadequately. This is the Virya Paramita. On and on we persevere, like small children, determined to learn to walk while continually falling down, or like a very old person getting up in the middle of the night, lurching from wall to reach the bathroom. They're such great images for us. And lastly, as you become more and more settled in your purpose, your circumstances begin to synchronize with your concern, with your concerns. And I think that's really true. And here are some ideas for your reflection during the week. Which kind of laziness do you relate to the most? And when did that kind of laziness begin? Under what circumstances? How did you deal with it? And how are you dealing with it now? Analyze it as if you were a doctor and you have a patient yourself with an illness to heal, laziness. So really, to examine your laziness medically, you're the doctor. And second idea for reflection during the week. Marie, in her famous book on tidying, tells us to throw all of our t-shirts, say, in a pile in the living room and pick them up one by one. And if it gives you joy, you should keep it. And if it doesn't, which you know instantaneously, then you throw it away. And so the second assignment here is give your life the joy test. Which parts bring you joy and which don't? And try to make everything in your life bring you joy. So otherwise, toss, throw it out. Anything in your life that doesn't bring you joy should go. And then thirdly, overwork is a form of laziness. Taking on things that are too advanced is a form of laziness. Not stopping when you're done, when you've done enough, is another form. And taking on practices that you might quit halfway through is another. So do you relate to these? And the assignment, please elaborate on when you do whichever one of those you do, and identify any patterns that you see that you might analyze and perhaps amend in some way for the better. So if there, do you relate to those things? And if so, what are the patterns that you see underlying them? And how can you make changes for the better? So in other words, patterns that underlie laziness of any kind. Fourthly, regarding preoccupied laziness, this type of laziness is the most dangerous because we use our life to avoid practice. We feel extraordinarily energetic when we exert ourselves in other things, but when it comes to sitting, we are very lazy. We'd rather vacuum the floor. If this is you, remember that at the core of the problem is forgetfulness, not only of your ultimate purpose, but the law of impermanence. So what is your ultimate purpose? And when you come to die, what will you feel the most proud of accomplishing? That's that question. And finally, we need to cultivate a sense of urgency around the Dharma. Practice itself with a no matter what attitude is the key. And the key to that is remembering impermanence. We could die today. What are you doing to cultivate a sense of urgency around the Dharma? That's the last question. What are you doing to cultivate a sense of urgency around the Dharma? In the name of time, I wonder if any of you have questions.
Yes, Gail. So the first one that we got is, one thing about Parna's attitude confused me. He said it would be okay if the people killed him. But how does that align with the concept that you don't want to encourage others to do things that would bring them bad karma?
If there may be many right answers to this question, but this is the one that comes to me. My understanding of the barbarism that filled the land of Sunna Paranta is that it was beyond the ability of one human being to succeed in that place. It just seemed inevitable to me that he would be killed, which he didn't mind because he was just gonna, he's already enlightened, he's an enlightened being and death means nothing to him. But it wouldn't do them any good. That's what he said. He was sorry because even though it would just speed his way to nirvana, it wouldn't be beneficial to them in any way. He could have gone on to say that, in fact, it would even add to their already dreadful karma. But as I say those words, it wasn't such dreadful karma to get Purna amongst them. And sure enough, Purna was able to do a lot of good. There's no real answer to your question. You couldn't criticize Purna. Purna's efforts to try to spread the Dharma there, with if they then tried to kill him, it would just add to their negative karma. It would definitely add to their negative karma, but the chances of spreading the Dharma there were worth whatever bad karma they were going to bring upon themselves. And if he succeeded, it would be way less bad karma than probably they've ever experienced, and then increasingly way less, until maybe all they would be doing is spreading good karma amongst themselves. I mean, he was a catalyst for turning bad karma into good karma there, if nothing else. I can't think of any other answer to your question than he had to take that risk if he wanted to spread the Dharma, which he obviously did. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The next question we have is, I think that Suzuki Roshi said that if you practice Zazen, then the precepts and everything else will take care of itself. Can you speak to this versus the practice of the paramitas on their own?
Yes. That is absolutely true. Actually, Zazen does everything. And in fact, regarding laziness, I think I'm pretty sure it was, I'm not sure which Roshi it was, but Sawaki Roshi, that's who it was accused of being lazy because all he did all his life was sit Zazen. But Zazen replaces everything. But since most of us don't just sit Zazen all our lives, and he not only sat Zazen, but he taught everyone else around him to sit Zazen too. So he generated a lot of Zazen in others as well as himself. But although everything is included in Zazen, we have, most of us don't just do Zazen, and we have these six perfections. They're perfections because they surpass themselves. They exhaust themselves in that they liberate themselves. Like generosity, the first one, it just keeps it. One act of generosity keeps boomeranging into other acts of generosity forever and ever, almost. So we need more. We humans who don't just sit Zazen all day, those of us who don't, which is everybody but Sawaki Roshi, need other practices to maintain our bodhicitta, which is our desire for our instinct really toward awakening. And these six practices support our awareness, our constant awareness of our own bodhicitta, our mind of awakening. Without something to do, really, to generate enthusiasm, to keep our bodhicitta active and alive, it could turn into confusion easily, too easily. We have to really struggle to remember that that is our main goal. It's attaining enlightenment or keeping on the mind of enlightenment is something that we care about almost more than anything. Because of what you almost could say, because of what happens when a human is without that, their lives turn into such chaotic confusion. It's so sad. So I think this question is pitting the paramitas against zazen, but really they're all important and they really can't be pitted against each other. Zazen may contain everything, but we don't do zazen all day long. And so we have to have some other practices too. And you can make what you already do into practice. And if you do that, then everything you do can be a practice, and you can use them for the Dharma. You can use everything you do as a Dharma. You can make everything you do into a Dharmic practice, and then your whole life becomes a Dharma practice. Try it and see. And one way to do it is giving away the merit. So I'm going to make my brushing my teeth routine into a practice. And I, first of all, give away the merit of everything that I'm about to do in my brushing teeth routine to all beings. And then I brush my teeth, etc. That's the way to make everything you do into a practice. And then they'll be equal to all their other Dharma practices, including the paramitas. I think we're out of time now. And I want to thank you for attending very much. And I want to thank my team, Sahar and Brian and Brendan, for all the work behind the scenes they do to make these talks possible. And I want to thank the people who listen during the week as well. Thank you. And I hope I'll see you next week. Bye. Bye-bye.